by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make heaven in the middle of it. Grass make heaven in the middle. We are grass make heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to be playing some clips from a wide variety of broadcasters this evening. And we're going to start off with Alex Jones. And he's trying to alert and the Trump administration to the real dangers that lie ahead. And Alex has always been out there in the forefront of leading the charge for liberty and freedom and maintain that in this country. And he has some important things to say. Well, anyway, we're going to start that off with Alex, then follow it on a story of what Barr, Attorney General Barr thinks about this Jeffrey Epstein. And then we'll unfold the program from there. Here we go with Alex Jones.
We have to educate President Trump before it's too late. We have to convince the president not to commit seppuku, not to commit political, cultural suicide, and not to destroy the Trump name forever. It will not be synonymous with overcoming adversity as a Trump card. It will be associated with upheaval and disaster. I know he's for real. I want to see what he does in his second term. I'm really blessed to be persecuted to support Trump. And I'll continue on no matter what, but I want Trump to do the right thing. And I won't sit here silently and do nothing. Trump has bet his entire family name on restoring the Republic. And I believe Trump means well and is for real. And on so many fronts, is trying to be a peacemaker, is trying to get our troops home from endless no-win wars, is trying to restore our sovereignty, is trying to make the president the president again and not just have it be a rubber stamp of the permanent bureaucracy. And there's no doubt that the president has gotten the establishment enraged and made them show their hand. But if they show their globalist criminal censorship, race war, divide and conquer, pedophile hand, and then we don't rise up and politically, culturally, economically beat them, well, then we have just simply summoned the whirlwind, summoned the hurricane, the typhoon, and allowed ourselves to be destroyed. We didn't summon this fight to lose. We initiated this countdown to win. President Trump has gotten the establishment to come out and openly admit their aims, to silence us, to end free speech, to break down the family, to turn the internet into a giant surveillance grid and a huge open-air re-education camp. I'm going to cover that next segment. Well, we don't let them then just normalize all of this and, you know, sit up there and watch Trump send out interesting tweets and he physically and personally overcomes them. But then we ourselves are hung out to dry and thrown to the wolves. Thrown overboard, President Trump must stand up for his constituency that's being bullied and attacked and lied about. Not from the position of a victim, but from the position of troops left behind. And President Trump must move against big tech for their racketeering, for their lying to Congress, for their monopolies, for their antitrust behavior. The trust they've set up, the monopolies. And they're working with foreign governments to suppress other foreign populations. And we see the beginning of that with the Hong Kong resolution. But Doesn't matter if Trump's good on 90% of issues. If he's derelict in his duty to stand up against this globalist onslaught, then President Trump is his own worst enemy and is committing political suicide.
To give you an example, there's a recent news item Fox had. Attorney General Barr was interviewed by the press recently, and he had this to say about the Jeffrey Epstein so-called suicide or possible murder. And he's coming down now on the side that it was suicide. Here's that special report from Fox.
Attorney General William Barr weighing in on the suspicion surrounding the death of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Barr saying he did have concerns following the apparent suicide in a Manhattan correctional center, and he tells the Associated Press, quote, "I can understand people who immediately, whose minds went to sort of the worst case scenario because it was a perfect storm of screw-ups. I'll just say there is good progress being made, and I'm hopeful in a relatively short time there will be tangible results." Joining me now is New York Post columnist Miranda Devine. Miranda, the AG also said that he personally reviewed the videotape coverage, and he can say that nobody entered the cell, that Epstein was alone the whole time.
Yeah, look, I thought that was pretty impressive that he personally did review that footage, but it also doesn't actually allay our suspicions that it wasn't a kind of a Frankie Five Angels Godfather 2 experience where someone actually went to Epstein and said, look, you might as well kill yourself because otherwise you know we can get to you because we did 2 weeks ago and it'll be much less pain-free. Mm-hmm. Better for you to do it on your own terms. So, you know, perhaps he did it that way. It doesn't allay anyone's suspicions that he knew had a lot of dirt on a lot of powerful people like Prince Andrew. And where are those videos and photographs? And he had peephole cameras in every corner of his mansion.
Right.
Where is the footage from that?
Exactly. Mm. So you mentioned Prince Andrew, and I'm curious what you think about this. He had this week where I think he thought, if I just do one media interview, I can resolve all the problems. Instead, it was like opening up Pandora's box. He now has been relieved of his duties by the Queen, and he said this: "It has become clear to me over the past few days that my association with Jeffrey Epstein has become a major disruption to my family's work and the valuable work going on in the many organizations and charities that I am proud to support." But interestingly, Miranda, this is a guy of such privilege that he just gets to walk away from his official duties of doing charitable work, and then he's scot-free.
But he's still getting paid by the Queen and a nice salary and living in castles. It's incredible that the realization only dawned on him the last few days, though. It was so stupid of him to have done that interview in the first place. It would have been better for him to just stay mum, even though everyone was calling out for him to talk. And especially the victims now, 16 of Epstein's victims who've filed a lawsuit against his estate, are calling for him to come and be interviewed by the FBI. Now, that'll never happen, but the interview was just so implausible on so many levels, from, you know, the sweating to "I don't hug." I mean, immediately the British papers and the New York Post pulled up evidence that he did sweat at that time and he did hug women. So, you know, if he lied about one thing, what else did he lie about? So he should have kept his mouth shut or done an interview with a friendly person. Yeah. Even have an in-house interview with someone from the royal family. It would have at least kind of put a better finish on the ridiculous
narrative. It might not be finished completely. We might not have heard the end of it yet. We'll keep in touch. Mm. You, Miranda Devine, and of course, we'll keep you informed too. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dana.
There's Dana Perino. She's really good with Fox. But anyway, this Jeffrey Epstein, he knew too much, and they had to get rid of him. And there was something, I think, in this report about Attorney General Barr had viewed the video, and there was no one in that hallway. Now they're saying these two guards never checked on him, so that keeps them out of the hallway. And I remember originally on this Epstein death, incarcerated, in fact, he was, you know, perhaps suicided, maybe killed, maybe murdered. I don't know. I think the question is still open. But I think the forensics on this video were in this hallway, there wasn't anybody in there. I think they've got to look at that very closely. Because if you can prove up that that video was legitimate, then you can say nobody was in there. If the forensics show that there was fiddling around with that video, then it just might not work out to tell you the truth. So anyway, we're coming up now on this impeachment, and this impeachment is growing and growing and growing. And, at the same time, what started off, okay, this couple of weeks, Zach Voorhees has been interviewed on, InfoWars and a plethora of other broadcasts. And we're going to replay, some of his feelings and some of his story, about how he got started in whistleblowing on Google and what they were doing. So here we go with Zach Voorhees right now. And then we'll talk some more things about the impeachment and wrap up with some other insightful things about free speech at Berkeley. So here we go now with Zach Voorhees. Let me preview this a little bit more. Zach Voorhees was a whistleblower. He was one of the upper level engineers at Google. He had accumulated some files that prove overwhelmingly that Google was using algorithms to influence different opinions within the public. And he alleges that some of these were election related. So here we go now with him.
I've been living with this burden for 3 years, since 2016 when they started changing everything, and to have that burden lifted off of my soul is, I've never felt happier or, you know, more at peace with myself than I have, right now. The police didn't announce themselves. I decided that I'm just not going to talk to them.
So, why are the police outside your home in San Francisco?
And so what I did is I put out a dead man switch. People are like, well, you're brave. It's like when I'm coming and explaining what Google was doing, this is an act of atonement, okay, to make my conscience clear.
They're not an objective piece. They're not an objective source of information. They are a highly biased political machine that is bent on never letting somebody like Donald Trump come to power again.
The Google whistleblower has come out of the shadows, this time releasing a large cache of remarkable confidential Google documents that expose Google's political bias and a scary progressive social agenda.
My name is Zach Voorhees, and I was an employee at Google for 8 years. And the reason why I collected these documents was because I saw something dark and nefarious going on with the company. I felt that our entire election system was going to be compromised forever by this company that told the American public that it was not going to do any evil. And I saw that they were making really quick moves, not only in the documents, but also in the internal speeches that the executives were giving to the company, that they were intending to do that. They were intending to sculpt the information landscape so that they could create their own version of what was objectively true.
It was June 24th. Project Veritas released an investigation that included an interview in the shadows with Google insider Zach Voorhees. Within days, it seems, Google was on to him.
What happened since you and I last spoke?
There's a lot of stuff that happened since you and I last spoke. I went back to San Francisco, and I laid low. And then, out of the blue, I got a letter from Google indicating that they knew what I had done. And that letter contained several demands, six of them, in fact, asking me whether I retained documents, asking me to list the people that I'd given the documents to, and requesting access to all of the data, all of my personal data, my laptop, my backup hard drives, in order for them to come in and start scrubbing all of it.
So we have the letter in front of us, and I have a copy of it here. This letter does make a few demands. It asks you to cease and desist. It asks you to comply by a certain date, no later than Friday, July 26th. Did you?
I did. I did comply. And I complied honestly.
What did you do?
What I told Google was that, yes, I had retained some of their files. And I told them that, yes, I had sent it out. And I told them truthfully that I had sent their files to law enforcement.
What law enforcement agency did you send it to?
The law enforcement agency that I sent it to was the Department of Justice Antitrust Division under Attorney General William Barr.
But according to Zach, Google's attacks on him had only just begun. A Twitter troll outed him as the leaker, saying,
"By the way, Zach, shouldn't you remove well-employed tech geek from your bio, Mr. Leaker?"
So who do you think One Snowflake is?
Well, I had my suspicions that it might be an insider from Google, since that information that he posted wasn't public. After I realized that Google knew who I was, I started going to lawyers and attorneys and trying to figure out what Google's likely next step was going to be. And both attorneys that I talked to both said, this is the first step in having your life ruined. They're going to come after you. And so I realized that this is what was coming to me. So what I want to let them know is, look, I've got your data. Yeah. And so what I did is I put out a dead man switch so that in case they were going to either try to destroy my life through the legal system or that they were trying to just, off me because, I'm exposing their a really big thing, how they are tampering with elections. I wanted to let them know that, hey, look, if something were to happen with me, then these documents are going to be released immediately.
And what is a dead man switch for those who aren't familiar with that?
So a dead man switch is something that people that have information about a corporation or somebody else, and they're concerned about their personal safety and possibly their life. And what they do is that they let that entity know that in the case that they get offed, that the information will be released to the public. Mm-hmm. And so I set up a dead man switch to trigger in the case that I was killed or assassinated. And so I let them know that I was willing to do that and to protect myself. The next day, the police began looking for me in two different locations. So Google decided to do a wellness check. And from what I've understood from other attorneys is that they're trying to establish that I've got some sort of mental problem in order to make their case easier. And this is a large way in which they intimidate their employees that go rogue on the company.
San Francisco police confirmed to Project Veritas that they did indeed receive a, quote, mental health call, unquote, and responded to Zach's address on that day.
Are you worried about your safety?
I was because, because the documents hadn't been released yet, the value of taking me off the chessboard was really high. And the expense of, taking me down, in which I wasn't well known, was very low. If nobody knows who somebody is, then if they take them off, then it's a conspiracy theory that the real reason was because of some nefarious cause. And so what I realized is that I needed to both increase the expense that Google would take to do something bad and also reduce the value of that successful operation. And so I decided that the best way to reduce the return on investment was to come public, release all the documents, and get the target off of my back. And so that's what I did, and that's why I'm here today.
Now, this is a confidential document, correct?
Yes.
This is not a document that Google has come out and admitted that this is their process.
That's correct.
And in this document, it says, I'm going to read from it.
In fact, if you brought this up without the document, they would say that this is a conspiracy theory.
Wow.
The internal Google documents from the story given to us by Mr. Voorhees reverberated through the halls of Congress.
In this Project Veritas video, which I did watch last night, they allege that there are internal Google documents, which they put on the video, and this is what it said. For example, Imagine that a Google image query for CEOs shows predominantly men. Even if it were a factually accurate representation of the world, it would be algorithmic unfairness.
In some cases, it may be appropriate to take no action if the system accurately affects current reality, while in other cases, it may be desirable to consider how we might help society reach a more fair and equitable state via product intervention.
What does that mean, Mr. Slater?
What do they mean by that?
So what they want to do is they want to act as gatekeepers between the user and the content that they're trying to access.
So this information about algorithmic fairness was given to Project Veritas by you.
That's correct.
How did you obtain this document?
So these documents were available to every single employee within the company that was full-time. And so as a full-time employee at the company, I just searched for some keywords and these documents started to pop up. And so once I started finding one document, I started finding keywords for other documents, and I would enter that in and continue this cycle until I had a treasure trove, an archive of documents that clearly spelled out the system, what they were intending to do, in very clear language.
So what you're saying is the public's right to know this information has a far greater value than whatever they can do to you personally as a result of you sitting and going on camera talking about it.
That's right. I mean, if I'm just on camera, that's just some dude's opinion. And, you know, who knows what that person's thinking. When they see the documents themselves, they're going to be shocked, they're going to be terrified, and they're going to be like, how can Google so blatantly lie to the American public and lie to Congress when there is a pile of evidence showing that what they're saying is untrue?
Here is another one of the documents that you leaked to us. This is, well, tell us what this is.
Okay, so this is a blacklist, one of many blacklists that are at Google. This particular blacklist is showing which news sites aren't going to show up underneath the search bar when people are searching on their Android phones. And what they're doing is that they're saying, okay, well, you know, Newsbusters, The Gateway Pundit, National Enquirer, Media Matters, InfoWars, they're not going to appear, you know, on their search results. And they're telling people that, oh, they don't have any blacklist. This is all done. You know, they don't have any political ideology. They don't have any political bias. But it's really clear that they do. And, you know, if Google wants to have political bias and they want to say that they've got political bias, you know, that is their right as a company. But for them to go under oath and say that these blacklists don't exist, while employees like me are able to just search through the internal search engine of the company and see that they do, is hypocritical at the least. And it's perjury at the worst.
Yeah, a lot of people ask us, what's the solution to this problem? Seems like what you're saying is the solution is to be honest about what it is that you're doing, at the very least. Do you think there are any solutions beyond that?
I think that, you know, Google needs to they've got a fiduciary responsibility to their stockholders to inform them of what the business is doing because they've invested into the company. And I'm a stockholder myself.
Well, Congress holds Google exempt, says they're just a platform. They're not interested in meddling in content or having an editorial position on anything. What do you say to that?
Google is playing both sides of the game. On one hand, they're saying that they are a platform and that they are immune from being sued for the content that they host on their website. On the other hand, they're acting as a publisher in which they're determining the editorial agenda of these certain companies, and they're applying that. And if people don't fall in line with their editorial agenda, then their news articles get de-boosted and de-ranked. And if people do fall in line with their editorial agenda, it gets boosted and pushed to the top.
You're one of a few people who have come to Project Veritas from the inside. You are someone who very recently worked for Google. In fact, you were speaking to us while you were an employee. Should others at Google come forward like you did?
Yes. And the thing is that, you know, for the people that are inside of Google right now, there's a lot of them that see what's going on and they're really scared. And they see what's going on. They're like, what the heck? Like, this wasn't the company that they signed up for. And a lot of them probably feel guilty like I did. Like, I felt incredibly guilty working for this company.
You decided to come forward. There are people within Google who are maybe on the fence about coming forward. And as you said, they are afraid of what might happen to them or something else. What is your message to those people on the fence?
I'm hoping that those that want to do something are going to be compelled to act, and that we together can come together and defend ourselves in the case of litigation.
A lot of people are going to be fascinated by you as a person, you as a human, willing to do this. I harp on it because it's quite extraordinary to people. We get asked these questions the most. What compels someone to sit in that seat in our offices and to go public like you have done? I mean, some say that you're a hero. Some are going to say that you have extreme moral courage. Some might say you're kamikaze or you're ignorant of what might happen to you. What do you say to them?
Here's what I say to them. You know, I always thought that when the time came to do the right thing in a big way, that I would always be the one that stood up and did the right thing. And I got tested because I was making a lot of money at Google. My yearly income from Google was $260,000. Okay? Once you factored in the stock. Wow. Okay? And so I had every incentive in the world to stay at the company and just click the paycheck. And I know that that's the decision most other people would make, which is just to click the paycheck. But I could never live with myself knowing that if Google was able to implement the plans that they were planning, that I, at the moment of choice, backed out because I was selfish. And I didn't want to have that on my conscience. And I felt guilty. And, you know, people are like, well, you're brave. It's like the feeling that I participated in what they were doing was actually worse. I feel that when I'm coming and explaining what Google was doing, this is an act of atonement, okay, to make my conscience clear. And if I didn't do this, then I'd have to live with myself for the rest of my life. And people aren't going to understand what I'm talking about until they see the documents, because it's really that bad. You know, they can stop like one or two of us, but they can't stop all of us coming out and explaining to the American public that this is what's happening, that Google is not who they say they are. I've been living with this like burden for 3 years, since 2016 when they started changing everything, and you know, and to have that burden lifted off of my soul is, I've never felt happier or, you know, more at peace with myself than I have, like, right now.
How did you come to find Project Veritas? How did you come to find us in your journey to go public?
So the reason why I came to Project Veritas to do this disclosure is, once I knew what Google was doing and I had an amount of documents to prove my thesis, I started to ask my network about who I could trust to, you know, get this out. And Project Veritas came up over and over and over again, as they were the only journalist, you know, outlet with enough integrity to be able to put this out to the American public. And what other people told me is, don't go to the establishment players.
Why not?
Because the New York Times and the Washington Post stab people in the back. They've long given up their investigative mandate. And they're not, you know, the legitimate news is coming from the ground up. And they're at this point just picking it, you know.
Right.
But the real news is made by outlets like Project Veritas that does real investigative journalism and has
you know, ethics and morality and want to see America thrive. I don't think a lot of these other news organizations actually want to see America thrive. I think they want to see it fall, you know. And so, you know, I knew that I could trust you. And honestly, the reason why Project Veritas has so much credibility is because of you, James, because you have the moral fortitude to stand behind this. And so I realized that I could put my back to you. And so that's what I'm doing. And you haven't let me down. And I appreciate everything that you've done for me and all the whistleblowers that have come forward to expose corruption.
Next, we've got Lou Dobbs at blowing the whistle on the 5G. And our FCC has just made a great decision that prohibits them from being used in the United States, some of their equipment and so forth. So here we go with Lou Dobbs. And also he talks about John Solomon and Fiona Hill. Fiona Hill made statements that were categorically wrong at the beginning of her testimony this week. Here we go now.
Good evening, everybody. The radical Dems and the 59 days of impeachment inquiry farce that they've conducted failed miserably to put forward a plausible pretext, even, with which to overthrow President Trump. They've also managed to build public support for the president. His approval numbers are on the rise despite those 59 days. Support for impeachment on the decline, in fact, and the Democrats are fortunate to have the Thanksgiving recess with which to recover and regroup. But those 59 days of absurdist political theater have awakened millions of Americans to the greatest political scandal in our nation's history, and more evidence is on the way. Those Democrats appear now to be well on their way to electoral disaster in 2020. President Trump, on the other hand, is strengthened and validated by the radical Dems' dismal and disastrous failures of their so-called impeachment inquiry. The president says, in fact, he wants a full trial of the facts in the U.S. Senate. President Trump, eager to expose further the corruption and baseless charges of the deep state and the radical Dems that track back to the Obama White House. President Trump today crowed about this banner week for his presidency.
Tremendous things are happening. I think we had a tremendous week with the hoax, you know, the great hoax, they call it the impeachment hoax, and that's really worked out incredibly well, and we have tremendous support.
And breaking news tonight, the FCC has unanimously voted 5-0 to ban U.S. telecom companies from using federal subsidies to buy or maintain equipment made by Chinese telecom companies Huawei and ZTE, labeling those companies a national security threat. The FCC also beginning the process that would force U.S. telecom companies to replace existing Huawei and ZTE products, a process that could cost more than $2 billion over 2 years. Well, joining us tonight, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. He's been focused on the issue of telecom and other companies using taxpayer money to buy from companies that pose national security risks to the United States for years. Commission Chairman Ajit Pai led that 5-0 vote today and joins us here tonight. Great to see you.
Great to be with
you. Congratulations on the vote.
Thank you.
A clear-cut statement of putting U.S. national security, national interest above commercial interest. And congratulations to you and the commission for doing so.
Well, thank you. It's a unanimous vote, and I think it speaks to the fact that when it comes to the national security of our communications network, we do not know a party affiliation. This is about the security of the country.
It is about the security of the country. Last week, the Attorney General of the United States announcing clearly that both these companies, Huawei and ZTE, posed a national security threat. In fact, he went further and said it's the conduct of the People's Republic of China that also goes into his assessment of their national security threat and the risk posed. How far is this going to go, and what are the next steps for the United States. These two companies have been featured prominently by the Chinese in their efforts to drive a potential espionage in this country and into the countries of our allies around the world.
Each of those two companies you mentioned has ties to the Chinese Communist Party and military. Each of them has engaged in conduct like intellectual property theft and bribery and corruption. Each of them is subject to China's national intelligence law, which requires them to secretly comply with requests from China's intelligence services. And so going forward, we propose to ban the use of FCC funding from being used by U.S. telecom companies on equipment or services from those two companies. And looking backwards, we want to understand if there is existing network equipment from those companies and to figure out how to rip and replace it. This is not a risk that we can simply indulge in this country.
That is, something that nearly every American is rejoicing upon hearing the chairman of the FCC say that. But we also are looking at a whole government here, the United States government. Is it a whole government effort that we're witnessing, or is it somewhat ad hoc still? In the midst of trade talks between the United States and China, in the midst of foreign policy concerns articulated by Secretary of State Pompeo recently in a speech declaring China's threats to this country is simply unacceptable.
All I can speak to is what the SEC believes. And from our perspective, these two companies, the entire government of China, presents a national security risk to the United States. And working with some of our federal partners, I've done many trips abroad where we've presented a coherent and consistent message to our allies
around the
world.
What's the response?
The response has been generally favorable. Other countries understand the risk, even if they haven't said so publicly, and they understand that they need to evaluate the risk to their own national security when it comes to incorporating equipment from untrusted vendors into their networks.
There's also a competitive risk here and a structural risk. That is, the companies that we assumed would be in the lead in this country on 5G, AT&T principal among them, haven't been hitting the markers and their projections. What does this mean competitively? What does it mean for the adaptation that will be necessary for U.S. telecom?
So from our perspective, we've been implementing what we call the FCC's 5G fast plan, getting more spectrum into the commercial marketplace, making it easier to deploy infrastructure of the future, putting in place the building blocks for any company, whether it's an existing wireless operator or new entrants, to be able to bid at spectrum auctions and to deploy that infrastructure at scale. And so we're working with all of the companies to give them a full and fair chance to compete. We want to make sure that every American company has the maximum incentive to develop and deploy 5G technologies here on our shores as opposed to other countries.
Are you concerned by what has been a lag on 5G by U.S. companies?
I think we are well positioned. We're positioned to have approximately 92 commercial deployments by the end of this year, 200,000 small cells. Spectrum is getting into the commercial marketplace at a quick rate. And so I'm hopeful, although we still need to maintain that lead vis-a-vis China and other countries that want to seize that opportunity for themselves.
And rural farm communities that are desperate for lower priced Huawei ZTE type equipment, is it replaceable, and is there a possibility, because Wilbur Ross talking on this broadcast this week, the Secretary of Commerce, very concerned about the implications for those rural communities who frankly just have a disadvantaged position when it comes to telecom period, but to 5G in particular.
That's a concern that I share, not just as a regulator, but as a rural American myself, having grown up in rural Kansas. But at the end of the day, one of the things we want to make sure is that our communications networks are secure, whether it's urban or rural. We are working with the rural carriers to make sure that they have a financing mechanism in place to have trusted vendors. And at the end of the day, my message to them, to anybody, is pretty simple. The only problem with cheap equipment from Huawei and ZTE is it eventually costs too much. And especially when it comes to the security of our country, I don't think that we can simply take a risk and hope for the best. We need to make sure the rural carriers and all of us are on the same page.
And to bear out the FCC chairman, the Attorney General said this in his letter to the FCC in point of fact. The Attorney General writing, "We should not signal that Huawei and ZTE are anything other than a threat to our collective security. Their own track record, as well as the practices of the Chinese government, demonstrate that Huawei and ZTE cannot be trusted." And again, congratulations on that 5-0 vote. Good for you. Good for the commission.
Thank you, sir. Really
good for the country. More importantly, thanks so much, Ajay. Good to see you. We're learning more tonight about the long-awaited report on FISA abuses by the Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz. The Inspector General has reportedly found evidence that former FBI attorney Kevin Kleinsmith manipulated a key document in order to justify surveillance of former Trump advisor Carter Page. That is to facilitate spying on a presidential candidate. The New York Times reports tonight Horowitz will likely absolve top-ranking FBI officials for abusing their powers, namely James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, and Lisa Page. We'll be taking up that story in greater detail and assessing what the prospects are for those folks who've been named to this point. Up next, the Trump administration issuing a new warning to left-wing activists. On Wall Street, stocks closing higher, the Dow up 109 points, the S&P up 7, the NASDAQ up 14. Volume on the big board, 3.2 billion shares as we round out this week. Markets finishing lower overall, the Dow down nearly 0.5% on the week, the S&P down 0.25%, the NASDAQ down 0.25% as well. Crude oil flat, trading at nearly $58 a barrel, gold down 0.25%, silver gaining over 0.25% as well. A reminder, listen to my reports 3 times a day, coast to coast on the Salem Radio Network. Well, former National Security Advisor John Bolton is back on Twitter. I know you couldn't wait, right? And taking shots at the Trump White House. Bolton tweeted earlier today, quote, "Since resigning as National Security Advisor, the White House refused to return access to my personal Twitter account. Out of fear of what, I may say. To those who speculated I went into hiding, I'm sorry to disappoint." The White House denied it blocked Bolton from his account, saying it doesn't have the means to do so, and Bolton himself adding further clarification later in the day. President Trump says he wants to call Adam Schiff, Hunter Biden, and the whistleblower to testify if the Senate holds an impeachment trial. President Trump arguing that calling these witnesses will provide him due process.
We couldn't have any witnesses. Right. We want to call the whistleblower. But you know who I want as the first witness? Because, frankly, I want a trial. You know, I could think I could have it.
You want a trial?
Whatever I want. Oh, I would. Look, number one, they should never, ever impeach.
And, of course, there should be due process from the very beginning, which they have denied this president and the American people. Well, joining us tonight, White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham. Stephanie, great to have you here.
Thank you.
The president standing straight up and saying, I think he also looked at those poll numbers and saw the way the American people are reacting to this charade put on by the Dems. He wants to go to have a full-on trial and raise a little hell, it appears.
Absolutely. When you've done nothing wrong and you've had to endure months and months of people saying that you've done all of these horrible things, I think that anybody would want to defend themselves. And I agree with him. I think Adam Schiff should go up first. You know, he has lied about what he knows about this whistleblower. We know for a fact that his staff was dealing with this whistleblower, a whistleblower who has a lawyer who tweeted on day one of this presidency that this president must go down. That's horrible. So I agree with the president. Let's put it all out there. If there's nothing to hide, let's go.
And as the radical Dems, as Adam Schiff put up all of these so-called witnesses to see time and time again, suggestion, speculation, presumption, assumption, hearsay, it became a parade of nonsense, only it was directed at the president of the United States. He has the patience of Job to put up with this nonsense.
He really does, and he continues to work for the country, which I admire so much. But you're right, I couldn't keep track of all the times the words presumption, I thought, I assumed. You know, and I want to point out that of all the witnesses that were spoken to during these sham hearings, the one witness who ever did speak directly to the president, albeit just a few times, he said unequivocally that the president told him, "I don't want anything. I don't want a quid pro quo. I want Zelensky to do the right thing. I want him to do what he ran on, which is corruption. To me, it should be over. I don't understand how we're continuing to talk about it.
Yeah, and that reference to Ambassador Sondland's testimony, which he left out of a 23-page opening statement, but which the Republicans reminded him was the essence of what he said, which was entirely exculpatory. But I have to say, the Republicans, ladies and gentlemen, stood up as I have never seen them in my career, shoulder to shoulder, and dismantling every one of those folks who tried to assault the President of the United States, and all of them baselessly.
I've got to say, it's been so amazing to see the Republicans so united, and I think that that's one of many ways this is all going to backfire on the Dems. The Republicans are so united behind this president. I think the country is united behind this president, too. They're seeing what's been happening to him for years. I've got to say, I was just handed a Vanity Fair article saying that it looks like this is going to work out for the Dems. And if we've got the Vanity Fair magazine saying that the Dems are going to lose this battle, that's really saying something.
That's a pretty high source for the
exactly.
The left of this country.
They don't generally like us.
It's Ambassador Bolton today with this nonsense about Twitter wanting his dedicated handle. That was never in the possession of the White House, was it?
Well, it was his personal account that he continued to use while he was at the White House. I don't know a whole lot about it, but sometimes I'll use my father as an example. Somebody who is of an advanced age may not understand that all you have to do is contact Twitter and reset your password if you've forgotten it. So I'll just leave it at that.
And I'm trying to quickly calculate whether Bolton or myself as the older fellow with a Twitter account. It's a shame to see Bolton behave like this, because this is a man who was next to the president, serving the president of the United States, and now is acting like it's just very disappointing that he would stoop to the level that he has, just in innuendo.
I hear he's got a book deal, and I hear he's been on quite the speaking circuit and charging some high fees for that. So I guess money can get you to do a lot of things.
Well, that's a shame.
Yeah.
Especially for a person who was in such a high and trusted position.
Agreed.
Stephanie, great to see you.
Thank you.
Congratulations on another terrific week
for
the president. And we look forward to many, many years more.
Thanks
so much.
Thank you.
Stephanie Grisham. We'd like to hear your thoughts on all of this. Share your comments. Follow me on Twitter at Lou Dobbs. Like me on Facebook. Follow me on Instagram at Lou Dobbs Tonight. And on a programming note, investigative reporter John Solomon, Congressman Mark Meadows, and Lee Zeldin among our guests here Monday evening. We hope you will be with us. Up next tonight, how Attorney General William Barr is now characterizing the suspicious death of Jeffrey Epstein. We'll have that for you. And John Solomon, fighting back against what has been a wholesale, highly targeted disinformation campaign against him during the Radical Dems impeachment farce. We'll have that and much more right after this quick break. Stay with us. Well, outrageous. Attorney General William Barr and Acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf today taking action, urging the Chief Justices of the Oregon and Washington Supreme Courts to stop blocking ICE agents from detaining illegal immigrants in their courthouses. The Attorney General and Wolf arguing their actions, those judges in those two states, pose an outright danger to the public. The Attorney General also describing the mysterious death of Jeffrey Epstein as a perfect storm. He died. Meanwhile, Britain's Prince Andrew reportedly has been kicked out of Buckingham Palace. The move comes days after the Duke of York, that's Andrew, defended his friendship with Epstein. Disputing Venman, award-winning journalist John Solomon today rebuffing Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Venman's claims this week that all the, quote, key elements of his Ukraine reports were false. Solomon laying out 28 separate rebuttals to the elements in question, and Solomon asking Venman to point out what was wrong with his reporting. Well, joining us tonight, Tom Fitton, the president of Judicial Watch. The attacks on John Solomon are extraordinary. No other reporter has done as much as Solomon to reveal what is going on in Ukraine. no one, I mean this across the board, in my reading of all of the coverage, no one has sourced his or her work even close to the degree that John Solomon has.
Well, frankly, between Vindman and Fiona Hill, it's like listening to Democratic operatives, you know, just spin
it
information.
Is.
And Solomon has the facts on his side on Ukraine. And it goes to show that the experts that the president is supposed to be relying on, as given to him by the deep state people like Hill and Colonel Vindman, they really don't know what they're talking about. Either they're ignorant or being mendacious in suggesting that Ukraine wasn't working with the Obama-Clinton gang to target Trump. Yeah. And it makes sense because the Ukrainians were distrustful of Trump because they didn't like him being not wanting to go to war with Russia.
You know,
this is just pretend it didn't happen is just, I don't understand it. It's either ignorant or they're misleading us purposely.
Or the other.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's a lot of question about which it is. Fiona Hill, actually saying that the Republicans were not acknowledging that Russia was responsible for interfering with the U.S. presidential elections in 2016. That was never the issue, never the case, and the Republicans pointed out that she was absolutely dead wrong. And the extent to which she pursued that untruth, it was, I thought, astonishing. Let's listen to Fiona Hill, the self-cast, at least, leading expert on Ukraine.
I've heard some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves. The unfortunate truth is that Russia was the foreign power that systematically attacked our democratic institutions in 2016.
And your reaction? I mean, that, by the way, the arrogance of that statement.
Was that John Brennan or Fiona Hill? I can't tell the difference.
Well,
no one's making the argument the Russians were playing around in our elections. Certainly they were playing with Hillary Clinton at trying to take out President Trump. They spent a few $100,000 on Facebook ads. That's pretty clear. No one's proven that actually took place in a court of law. But no one knows whether they were doing it to help Clinton, to help Clinton or to help Trump. The dispute is, were the Russians in it to help Trump or were they in it to help Clinton? And it's the dossier people that were pushing the lie or the information without evidence that the Russians were in there to help Trump. You know, I'm glad she's no longer in the White House.
Well,
I'm really glad.
I would hope that many of these people will never again be in the White House because they're...
No matter the administration.
Vindman talking about Zelensky being asked about whether Zelensky served in the military. He didn't know the answer to it, and he considers himself the leading expert, not Fiona Hill. But not to know that, even though apparently the Zelensky government offered him the role of defense minister, he should know about
a well-read American citizen knows more about Ukraine and their corruption as it tied to the Clinton and Obama and Trump issue than the two experts that were paying to advise the president. I don't know why Vindman's still at the White House. I really don't.
It is difficult to understand, to comprehend what this president has had to put up with. The abject disloyalty and just simple honor. You would think that a president should expect better.
He was right to rely on Rudy Giuliani rather than those two.
Yeah, well, indeed he was. IG Michael Horowitz is coming forward with his report. The suggestion is that perhaps there will not be great accountability for the top level of the FBI and Justice Department. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't know if that's spin or not.
I don't know. Kinda,
you know, but it wouldn't surprise me because that's what IGs do. They're both cover-ups.
And he may not be the only one spinning.
Right? Yeah, they're both cover-ups and exposés at the same time. The last big IG report that exposed the Strzok page hatred for Trump and pro-Clinton activity, he pretended that it had nothing to do with the investigation.
Right.
And I suspect we have evidence of crimes taking place in the targeting of Trump. And are they going to really tell us that had nothing to do with what Comey and, I mean, Brennan is attacking Trump every day. And the idea that he was running the CIA and running operations against him, they're not going to draw any adverse conclusions there. The president needs to appoint a special counsel directly to get at this. I really do think we just can't rely on the current system to do it. He's got to bring in someone separate.
Well, I can't wait for the Durham report, the Barr conclusion to this. I remain somewhat optimistic.
Well,
I know that makes me alone on this set right now.
I'm always outraged because I am optimistic, and I expect people to do the right thing, and it just doesn't happen.
Well.
That was Judicial Watch, Tom Fenton, and they've done some great things. We're going to end here. The ADL, Anti-Defamation League, along with the Berkeley, there's a lab out there, have announced that they're going to be doing some hate research with their mainframes and so forth for hate speech identification on the web and so forth. So here we go with that announcement.
ADL and the University of California at Berkeley's D-Lab have been working to develop a new approach to tackle online hate using the latest methods. The goal of the Online Hate Index is to help tech platforms better understand the growing amount of hate on social media and to use that information to address the problem. By combining artificial intelligence and machine learning with social science, the Online Hate Index will ultimately uncover and identify trends and patterns in hate speech across different platforms. We've just completed our first phase of research, and we found that the machine learning model identified hate speech accurately between 78 and 85% of the time. In the next phase of our project, we will look at specific targeted populations in a more detailed manner. We'll examine content on multiple social media sites, and we'll identify strategies to deploy the model more broadly. While there's still a long way to go with artificial intelligence and machine learning-based solutions, we believe the Online Hate Index will help tech companies better understand the extent of hateful content on their platforms by creating community-based definitions of hate speech.
These kinds of operations are going to limit our free speech. But I have an interesting article that was written on the advent of the 50-year anniversary of the free speech movement out in Berkeley, California, University of California at Berkeley. It was written by Saul Stern. And here's what he had to say. He was one of the leaders of the free speech movement. We early 60s radicals believed ourselves anointed as a new tell-it-like-it-is generation. We promised to transcend the smelly, odd orthodoxies in Orwell's phrase of Cold War liberalism and class-based authoritarian leftism. Leading the students into the university administration building for the first mass rally, Mario Savio, the free speech movement's brilliant leader from Queens, New York, famously said, "There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes too odious, makes you sick at heart that you can't take part. You've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all." Now, here's what Sol Stern says is going on in Berkeley now. The Berkeley machine now promotes FSM, Free Speech Movement, Keshe. The steps in front of Sprout Hall, the central administration building where more than 700 students were arrested on December the 7th, 1964, have been renamed the Mario Savio Steps. On one of the campus dining rooms is called the Free Speech Movement Cafe. Its walls covered with iconic free speech movement photographs and other mementos of the glorious semester of struggle. The university also requires entering freshmen to read a fawning biography of Savio written by a New York University professor and former Berkeley graduate Robert Cohen. A privately sponsored lecture series in Savio's honor, dominated entirely by leftist speakers, will be hosted by the College of Letters and Science in making the announcement. Dean of Social Sciences Carla Hess declared, "I think it is fair to say that the attitude of the administration towards the free speech movement has evolved over the past 50 years from fear to pride in what the students at that time stood for and what they accomplished." Now they have to take certain courses and so forth there that are mandatory, and there's no free speech movement at Berkeley anymore. They're conditioned into a political correctness that is unheard of. But thank you for listening tonight, and I'll post this article up on The Secret Truth. Thank you for listening.